cliffcentral.com.
Dr. Mampela Rampele has just released a book called Dreams, Betrayal, and Hope. And you've been off the political scene for a little while after there was that much publicized would-have-happened marriage between Akgang and the DA. We're not even sure of who's in charge at Akgang anymore, but you can help clarify all of that for us in a short while. I'm more interested in the ideas of what you think we should be doing and where you think we should be going. And that's exciting because we're at a point in South Africa where there's so much going on, where the supposed leaders are running like chickens without heads in various directions. The ANC is falling apart before our very eyes. And I think a lot of people are extremely confused. You've always been, for many, a voice of reason. You've been someone who has brought to bear your own academic point of view, your academic background, your black consciousness background, an understanding of business. In many ways, I think a lot of people think that you are where those circles overlap. And maybe that's where so many people put their hopes and dreams for Akgang into the last elections. And I mean, your book is entitled Dreams, Betrayal, and Hope. So let's start with the dreams. This isn't where you wanted Akgang to end up, and this isn't how you wanted your political career to go. Are you are your dreams deferred?
No. I believe that my dreams were unrealizable at the time that we launched Akgang. Akgang was an idea way ahead of its time. And my idealism about what this country is capable of made me unaware of the extent to which South African citizens, black and white, were still living in the past. In the past, in the sense of we have not yet taken charge, as we said in the preamble of our constitution in 1996 when we adopted it. We didn't say we the leaders, we said we the people adopt this constitution so as to, and we set ourselves four goals to heal the wounds of the divisions of the past, to establish democratic and open society values so there is equality before the law for everybody. The third point is to address the quality of life issues for every citizen so that we can free the human potential, so that every citizen becomes a contributor, not a consumer. And finally, we said we will build this into a democratic, proud, sovereign nation that will take its place in the family of nations.
And we've not achieved
one. We have not achieved any of those four things. And the reason is that post-1996, activists like me and others checked out and went our separate ways. The private sector, which had been the midwife in the background, working to enable the CODESA 1 and 2 and finally the adoption of the constitution, they got all they wanted, and the consultative business movement went to pot. And young people who were born after 1994 grew up in an environment in which there was, quote unquote, nothing to struggle for, and just focus on me, myself, and I. And we entrusted the growth and the development of our democracy to the governing party, as they call themselves, the ruling party. And that was done under the umbrella that they liberated us, which is an ahistoric fact. They contributed significantly to the liberation process.
The people of South Africa
but
liberated
the people
themselves.
Of South Africa liberated themselves, starting with my generation of very small group of students who started the Black Consciousness Movement. At that time, the country was in the grip of fear. Fear of the unknown, fear of the brutality of the then apartheid government, and fear of being caught on the wrong side of the law. But we, by freeing our minds from fear, from the even the labeling of people who look like me as non-white, non-Europe. Imagine, you are in Africa.
The majority of the people are non-white, but you refer to them as a non-something rather than
exactly.
as something.
But that itself was a signal of how we as the majority population, the indigenous population, had accepted our conquest and the subjugation under a series of minority governments. And we had accepted white people as the standard by which we were to be judged.
And you still see it. You hear arguments from black intellectuals even who compare themselves, that they use the standard for goodness and for success as being a white standard of
absolutely.
Goodness and success.
And if you excel academically, you are making yourself white.
Yeah.
You are playing white.
Yeah.
So the minds of South Africans is not yet free from the humiliations of the racist, exploitative system which has been running for the last 300-400 years.
Well, you take some time, and I really enjoyed the chapter about names, because this is an important part of and we don't talk about these things in South Africa enough. What's in a name? It's a whole chapter. You talk about how black people were given kind of nom de plumes. They were given these names by their white madams or their bosses or their teachers or the nurse or the doctor who gave birth, helped the mother give birth to them. These were not their names. These were not what they would call themselves at home or with their families, but these became their names. And it's almost like you create a separate existence for that person. And you never really can respect someone if you don't bother to learn what their actual name is and how to pronounce it. This is important.
Absolutely. But we, and I mean both black and white South Africans, have allowed this indignity to continue. You have people who will deliberately name their children so that they can be able to have names that are pronounceable. And their
beauty
own,
and patience
and fabulous and
yeah.
welcome and Christmas and all of those. Now, when you think about it, if you are not named in terms of your traditional system of naming, which most African communities have got those in place, which track you back to where you came from. Now, human beings are created for being connected. You are not only connected with your fellow live human beings, but you are connected to your ancestors through those names. Like my name, Mampila, is my grandmother, my mother's mother's name. So each time my mother didn't even call me Mampila, she called me Mama. Now, imagine what that evokes in me. The sense of pride that I am carrying the legacy of that grand old lady called Mampela. But even today, people I've worked with for years, they still call me Mafila, Mampele, whatever.
There's absolute disrespect.
Disrespect and tone deafness. There is another problem which came after 1994. Our governments, successive governments have failed to put in place African languages, African history, not 1652 history, but ancient African history, to help young African and young indigenous people to know that Africa did contribute to human civilization. It was, in fact, not just the cradle of humanity. It was the cradle of civilization along the Nile River.
Yes, because black people have a very important reason to be very proud of their contribution to civilization and to be proud that civilization exists not without them, and it didn't happen in some faraway place. It happened here in the beginning. If we hadn't learned here in Africa to stand upright, we would not be humans now.
That's the point.
All of us.
That's the point. But importantly, post 94, we didn't go and revise our history books so that we could not start Africa where white people came to Africa, but Africa was.
We just didn't learn about history before apartheid.
Absolutely. We didn't learn also about the history of the world. Now, there is a beautiful little book which came out in 2015 called The Silk Road. I would recommend it to anybody who wants to understand how the world came to be the way it is. It is a history that lets you understand that Asian countries were way civilized before the Europeans could actually understand that there is something called silk or spices and so on.
Makes you wonder why God sent Jesus to the Middle East, where they couldn't write or read, and he didn't send him to China, where 3,000 years before they'd already discovered writing.
Well, in fairness, the Middle East is, when you talk about Egypt and Palestine, and they did, in fact, have the original writing, the hieroglyphics and so on.
Yeah, sure. And Mesopotamia.
The Hebrew people were a people who were people of literature. And so we really have to relearn our history, which unfortunately in our schools, in our universities, is not being taught properly. It's very attenuated. And so young South Africans grow up without understanding how we came to where we are. Now, it's in that context that you have a governing party which loses all sense of accountability to the population. And it does so in the name of we liberated you, therefore you will be obedient to us. That's not what a constitutional democracy is about. A constitutional democracy is about anybody in government, in public service, being a servant of the people. The sovereign is the citizen, not the president, not the ministers. And so we have a South Africa governed by people who probably have never read the constitution, but worse, voted in by people who too have never paid attention to what we committed ourselves to. And so this book is an offering that's saying to South Africans, we had a beautiful dream in 1994. We encapsulated it in our constitution, but we didn't live it. We didn't give it the legs, the wings that it needed. What we now need is to reimagine our society in the way that the heroes of the struggle would love to see it being, in the way in which our children today and tomorrow would be proud. But that is not going to happen unless we go back to that preamble and start with healing the divides, healing the wounds of those divides. And that means that black people have to acknowledge that they still suffer from inferiority complexes in relation to white people. White people have to recognize that they suffer from superiority complexes. And so our humanity as black and white South Africans is undermined by those complexes. So we need to heal ourselves by acknowledging the pain, acknowledging the fact that white people are enjoying the privileges that come from that dehumanization that was apartheid and colonial government. And so we need to now, having acknowledged that, forgive ourselves and link hands to rebuild this society into this beautiful country it can become.
I really don't think there's anything that you've ever said that I've disagreed with.
From Cliff, this is quite something to say.
No, because you seem to me to, you know, for a while you were outside of politics. In every way, you were the chancellor at UCT. We all knew about you because you would write these extraordinary pieces on what, you know, it meant to be paying attention to the Constitution, what it meant to be citizens in an open democracy and all of that stuff. And I thought, this is someone who really does know what she's talking about. I see you carry the Constitution around. You carry a copy of it with you wherever you go. But most South Africans don't care about that. They don't. Well, if they do, they have sort of a... It's almost like you say you're religious maybe because you go to church once every 6 months. We like to claim the Constitution as ours when good things happen and when we see justice being done. But we don't take responsibility for upholding all of those rights in that first chapter of the Constitution. We don't fight for our freedom of expression every day. We don't fight for equality. We don't fight for the principles of the people first. We kind of just let things be taken over by elites. And I feel like in this country now, there are a lot of ordinary people who just go, oh, well, this is the way it is. It used to be a minority of white people who controlled everything. Now it's a minority of ANC people who control everything. And we're just on the outside, and we'll never get to look in.
Well, let's remember that apartheid lasted as long as it did, precisely because of that attitude. And now, post-1994, we have no excuse, because whatever, however bad the governing party might be, they cannot stop us from expressing ourselves. They cannot stop us from taking them to the courts if all else fails. But we shouldn't have to get there first. You know, my biggest sadness is that we are not teaching this constitution in life orientation in our school systems. We've got university students doing political science who have never opened this constitution. And then when things go wrong, we want to run to the constitutional court. The biggest defense of this constitution ought to be in the orientation, the enabling of all South African citizens to understand and embrace the values of this constitution. And that can only happen if we treat this constitution the way, as you refer to, religious bodies. You can't be a Christian unless you
have a Bible and you read.
And you can't be a Jewish observer without opening the Torah, or a Muslim without the Quran. So why do we think we can have a functional democracy without us paying attention to the foundations of our constitutional democracy? If we were to do this in our education system, in our workplaces, that part of workplace orientation, induction, ought to be about what does it mean to be a citizen of a constitutional democracy, and how does that translate into you being a worker, a manager, a CEO. And the same thing in our faith-based organizations. Faith-based organizations are called to healing. Now, why are they not occupying that first bullet?
They could do so much valuable good there, and instead they allow themselves to be used as a platform by politicians for campaigning.
Unfortunately, that has been the case. But there are, in fact, there is, in my view, huge scope, because remember, the faith-based organizations were at the forefront of the mobilization process in the 70s, in the 80s, and in the early 90s. I'm very pleased to see that we are finding our voice again as citizens through these public demonstrations of displeasure and the statements about what we really would like to see in our country. But that statement of what we would like to see in our country would be much stronger, much more positive, if it was based on the values of this constitution. Not just to say what we are against, but what are we for? We should be engaging in public protest at the failure to promote the healing between black and white people, and the failure of white people to acknowledge the privileges that they enjoy. We need to be absolutely dogged in insisting that our children are taught the values of our constitution, the respect for human dignity, the respect for themselves, which will then make them less vulnerable to substance abuse and all the other abuses, including teenage pregnancies. We owe it to our children to make them feel proud of their history as Africans. Yeah. Because whether you are black or white, you live here, you are an African. So why not take ownership of this beautiful continent and understand where we come from and celebrate the real richness of African culture? I mean, we talk very glibly about umtu ngumtu ngabani. It's not a simple slogan like that. It's a deep philosophical statement that I can see you in me and you see me in you. And that way, our relationships become much deeper. They're not just, you know, fair weather relationships. They are relationships that would allow us, enable us to work together, to encourage one another, and to correct one another as we build this great society.
You know, there's no diminution in your fire, your fury. You're still, I mean, when did the political train get derailed? Because I really did hold out a lot of hope, and I think a lot of South Africans did. They saw potentially an opposition with the moral high ground, with some real brains, some interesting kind of new thoughts and ideas brought to bear. We got excited, and then what happened? I mean, tell us the story now with a couple of months of history that we can, you know, look back on.
I think we need to make a distinction between party politics and politics.
Okay.
I have never left politics since I became conscious of the importance of citizen action.
Okay.
But party politics, without the basic foundations that are laid out in this preamble, has become transactional politics. And so it's very difficult to get black people who have been dehumanized, have been robbed of their dignity, have been betrayed so often, to believe that there is an alternative way of doing politics, which is not about lies, about corruption, about negative politics. And so a lot of people liked what I said on the campaign trail during the Ahang campaign. But the problem was that they didn't see how that was going to change their lives. I'm getting social grants, and because they don't have the orientation of understanding the difference between government, the state, and the role of the citizen in that, they think the money comes from the ANC, and they're told, if you don't vote for the ANC, gone are the social grants.
So it's kind of, it's a sort of, they're shackled even there.
Because
they don't believe they have an option. So even if Mampela Rampili comes to them and says, listen, this is how it works. They've been so indoctrinated into this.
Yes, but it's not as
we're talking obviously about, you know, a lot of, not everybody, but a lot of people in sort of rural outlying areas in South Africa, grannies who are running a household of maybe kids and grandchildren. They're looking after families that aren't even their families necessarily. They're the only breadwinner in many of these situations. For them, it's life and death. That social grant, as small as it is, helps them to pay the school fees, get food on the table.
Absolutely. But the interesting thing, Cliff, is that in those rural areas where I had lived and worked the people understood the links. So when I explain that no one can take away your social grants because they come from my taxes, they come from the state, not from an ANC government or a DA government. They understood it and they could trust me because I had worked with them. But that means, as far as I could tell, that one needed a lot of groundwork to get that message of a different form of politics to be grounded.
So that was the problem you had speaking to black people. But speaking to white people, you also had a problem.
A big problem. And the big problem there is, first of all, stereotyping. I'm woman, I'm black, what do I know? And how can they trust me? And that is actually is the trust story which broke down that marriage which was supposed to have happened. Because the traditionalists within the DA understood, in fact, it wasn't a question of misunderstanding. They understood that my kind of mindset and politics was going to change the nature of the DA. And they were not ready for that. Because as far as I was concerned, the DA has, even today, has the best political machinery that you can imagine in terms of modern machinery of party politics. But their ability to translate these four bullet points in the preamble of our constitution into a credible program is limited because they haven't started with the healing and the acknowledgement that they are where they are, whether they are the Stellenbosch Mafia or they are big JSC company CEOs, that they are there not because they were the smartest people in South Africa, but they were there at the right time, and so they are beneficiaries of the legacy of a system that excluded me and a lot of smarter people than me who could have become billionaires and whatever. But it's not about being a billionaire. It's about how can we build an inclusive socioeconomic system which would actually make this country much more prosperous. Because we know that in terms of inequality, we take the cake. 10% of South Africans own 60 to 65% of the wealth. In other countries which are unequal, it's 30 to 35% of. So you think this is an accident? No. And 80% of the 10% are white people, white males predominantly. Do you think that's an accident? Or is it because they are the smartest people? No. They are beneficiaries of a system that was geared to put them ahead. And they have to come to grips with the fact that even their own wealth is at risk unless we learn to acknowledge the trauma of the past and to deal with it and to help those who were on the receiving end of that trauma to also heal. And the best way of healing is to correct the gross inequalities. That how can we have a city like Johannesburg where the poorest black people live the furthest away from the resources of the city? You go to Tshwane, same thing. My own beautiful Cape Town is an eyesore. When you fly in, the beauty of the peninsula is mocked by the scars of apartheid in places like Khayelitsha and Blekkiesdorp, Noga. So, I believe that this country can become so much better if all of us were to accept our responsibility to work together to heal, so that the metaphor I use in the book is the three-legged pot. We have a very strong leg, which is the political settlement, anchored by the constitution. A very short leg, which is the dysfunctional, underperforming economy, because too few people are included in it. And we have a non-existent third leg, which is the emotional settlement that's needed. So if we were to address this absent link and create it together, the emotional settlement where white people actually unburden themselves of the guilt, the shame, and the denialism that diminishes them as human beings, we would do away with the stereotypes that make many white CEOs, when a black woman or a black young man walks in, they are suspecting that person of incompetence simply because they look incompetent.
Right. Yeah.
Okay? And when they speak without the accent, that exact, the standard accent, it must be that they're not as smart as the people who can speak English very smoothly, Model C kind of accent. Now, that immediately undermines the growth of that company. Because how can you grow a company in a country where 80% of the people look like that young man you suspect of incompetence? So you are denying yourself a broader base of clientele,
sure,
of customers, of talent. It's crazy. From an economic point of view, it's crazy what we are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And second, we have a country which could be setting an example of how, by addressing the wounds of the past, we are able to build a formidable socio-economic system. Because what will happen is, by unburdening ourselves of the guilt and the shame and the rage in the black community, which is really now palpable, we will transfer that energy into creativity. We will then be able to appreciate the real substance of unity in diversity, not a slogan, a real lived reality in our homes, in our workplaces, in our places of worship, in our cities. Can you imagine what this country would look like if we were to tap into the talents of every young person? And I believe it doesn't have to wait for 2019. It could start today. Each one of us in our homes have got someone called Gladys. Can we just go and find out what her real name is? Can we just find out how many children she's got, where she comes from, where she lives?
Yeah.
And who looks after her children while she's looking after yours? And that conversation alone would free you of the sense of entitlement or guilt or shame. And together you can actually have a much healthier, happier domestic environment. And that then enables you, as Mr. CEO or Mrs. CEO or whatever, to be a better person in your place of work.
Well, that's the Ubuntu definition you gave earlier, but it's also just plain old respect.
Very simple.
So you said party politics is transactional. Are you deeply suspicious of politicians?
I'm not suspicious of politicians because they are politicians. I'm suspicious of politicians under the current system of values that drive
in
politics.
In all the parties?
In all of the parties, yes.
Even Bantu Holomisa, Monsieur Lekota.
It's not about individuals.
No,
it's
no,
about,
but I mean these are,
yes,
those parties you're suspicious of as well. The
it's
whole
not a
system.
Question of being suspicious of the individual parties. It's a question of being critical of the ability of the South African party system to deliver on the promises that we made in the preamble of our constitution. Because none of those parties have prioritized the issue of emotional settlement. Yes, we talk about it. We talk about we need another CODESA. But we can't just have a CODESA. It's very difficult and very expensive to have that sort of process. Why don't we start where we are within these parties? I mean, you earlier asked about AHANG. Even within AHANG, we didn't succeed in shifting the mindset so that people are not in AHANG to pursue their own individual interests, but they're there to prepare themselves to be leaders in a different form of politics. Right. And that problem you will find in every political party in South Africa. But when you are the governing party, that culture, that political culture then tends to pollute the public service. And there is evidence everywhere you look.
Yeah, and this, it seems to me like the politicians don't really care about us after the election.
Like, well,
before and during the election, they're working their magic, you know. They're going around and glad-handing and picking up babies and promising this and promising that. And as soon as the election's done, they go, I think we can go back to looking after ourselves now.
Well, we get the leaders we deserve. Because it's not as if this is the first 10 years of our democracy. Why have we gone back each time when they come back to remember us to vote for them again? I mean, it's one thing to make one mistake, to make it twice, three times. It's called madness. And so we as South African citizens ought to ask ourselves the question, what is it that we need to be doing to put ourselves in a better position to make the kind of political choices that are going to help our country move forward? I'm very encouraged by what happened during the local elections.
Yeah.
That we are beginning to see cracks in the kind of loyalty politics that have been running the country thus far. But those cracks need to be more than just cracks. They need to be new foundations for the kind of politics that will enable the emergence of a coalition government, perhaps in 2019, that would reflect the diversity of South Africa's people and also the aspirations of the least amongst us. Not in a paternalistic way through grants, but in terms of two key areas.
Yeah.
One, education. We spent one of the largest percentages of government expenditure on education, and yet we have the worst outcomes, even in Africa, amongst poor countries.
Yeah.
Because we have failed to hold our leaders accountable for poor quality education. We have young people not being able to afford staying in the university because there isn't enough funding. But we've got funding for blue light boys. We've got funding now for a nuclear deal. That means our priorities are really not the ones that we should have. We need to have high quality, accessible, and in my view, we can afford free education for everybody from preschool all the way to university.
All right.
And at the university level, when you qualify, like I did, you go and work for government for 3 years as a way of paying back.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite doable. But we are not doing that because we are looking after, as the elites are looking after our own children, we send them to private schools, and we can afford to pay for university. The second thing we need to do is to seriously look at how human settlements are continuing the process of humiliation of South Africa's people. We need to transform our cities completely and the rural towns, and that will itself generate momentum for economic growth because we need to relay the pipes, we need to lay out new roads and create sustainable housing.
Yeah, and not embarrassing housing, you know.
Well, those are, as Makura said, nightmare. The so-called dream that has turned into a nightmare called the RDP.
Yeah.
It's an insult to the dignity of poor people, and the majority of those are black people. How can a black government do that to people who look like them? They could be their grandmothers. You give them something that you know is going to crumble tomorrow.
Terrible. And even the layout of sort of new areas where we would know better. You know, what's done is done in terms of most of city planning in South Africa. But there are places we're building new communities now, and we're not laying them out properly.
Well, take the case of Tafelberg in Cape Town.
Absolutely.
Why can't that building and that property be turned into proper social housing in the middle of Cape Town? Because their royal highnesses don't think that black people belong there. Poor people don't belong there. So our mindset is an apartheid mindset. The same apartheid geography model pertains to the way we lay out cities. A black government that has been in place for the last 23 years continues to have RDP housing the furthest away from the city center. It's crazy.
You do write quite a lot about education in here too, and I know you've told the story a million times, but how did you become the black consciousness activist at that stage of your educational history? How did it happen for you?
Well, I was very fortunate to end up at the University of Natal non-European section in 1968 to find an environment where African students were studying alongside Indian students and color students. It was the first experience I had of it. And I was also fortunate in that Steve Biko, who was one of those students, had been involved in NUSAS politics, the National Union of South African Students, and went to a conference middle of 1968 at the at Rhodes University, where they had taken a decision as NUSAS that if they were to be separated between black and white in terms of residential spaces, they would all walk out. Lo and behold, the white students just disappeared into the white residences, and black students were shown a church in the black township. And this is Grahamstown in winter. Now, can you imagine an empty church hall with mattresses on the floor? That was a statement of you as black students, that's what we're with. So Steve left furious, disappointed, and thank God, because that told him in no uncertain terms that you cannot expect people who are beneficiaries of a system to dismantle that system. The dismantling of a system of oppression has to be led by those who are on the receiving end.
Mm.
And then you can, as we did, convert the rest to the idea that even their own freedom is compromised by the lack of freedom for the majority. And that's how we got going. And as a complete rural bumpkin, I was totally politically naive, and so I cut my political teeth in the next few years understanding the importance of identity. Who you are determines what choices you make, what kind of person you become, and how you conduct yourself in life. And the beauty of it is that it enabled us to develop the kind of politics that does not require a party. The kind of politics that starts with change starts with you.
Mm.
And once that you have been changed inside, no one can stop you. That's why even today, at the age of 70, I'm still at it, because the country is not yet free.
But you had, for a young, you call yourself a country bumpkin, you had a huge amount of confidence, or did that grow?
Well, the confidence, the initial confidence came from the knowledge from the time I was a little girl that I had something ticking in my skull. And so I had the confidence that I had a brain that could enable me to do whatever I wanted to do. And so now with the consciousness raising, that simply added fuel to this fire of confidence, and the realization that it wasn't just being free as a black person and naming yourself black instead of non-white, but it was also free as a woman, that you can't divide me between an oppressed black person and then a woman who must stay in her place.
Yeah.
So I was able to develop an integrated view of freedom, which has never left me.
Do you think, because you knew him so well, do you think Steve Biko could have become a political leader in modern South Africa? And do you think he would have been one of the people who would have led us to freedom, perhaps before 94 or after 94? And what kind of a person do you think he might have become had he been allowed to live?
It's always dangerous to say anything about someone who was barely 30 when he died, and now I'm 70, so it's a good 40 years ago. But the fact of the matter is that he was already a national leader, and he died whilst preparing to go and meet the likes of O.R. Tambo, so that the divisions between the inside and outside liberation movements and the outside liberation movements, which are also fragmented, could be addressed so that we could all focus on national liberation, but not liberation from only, but liberation for a South Africa that we could really all be proud of, a South Africa that we could build together. And so I think he was a man way ahead of his time.
Absolutely.
And he was a man, young as he was, with a very profound way of looking ahead. And so it's not surprising that he ended up being killed by the security police, because he wasn't the kind of person who would have taken the humiliation of being frog marched or whatever.
How do you remember hearing about his death?
Oh, that was... You know, I still feel that pain, because I was in hospital expecting our son. And in a way, talking of human connectedness, I started having premature labor at the time he was being tortured. So my own cosmology tells me that there was
something going on.
Something going on. And on the morning I heard that he was killed, the day before, I had the contractions were so bad that they had to transfer me to Polokwane Hospital. And I remember crying all the way in the ambulance, and got there, and the doctor had to calm me down and sedate me. And I just had this kind of weepy thing, and I didn't know why. I knew he was in detention, but I was not worried, because he had been detained so many times, that I knew he was going to come back, because, you know, he came back before. So when I got the phone call from Tenjiwe Mtinso that Steve is dead, the lights went off. And that's is the worst news I ever received in my entire life. And it remains so.
Do you still think of him when you read our constitution, when you wrote your book? You think
all
of
the
him
time.
All the time?
All the time, because I have his son who looks so much like him. And I'm very proud of him, because he's already published a book, as you know.
Oh. How is he doing? What's he up to?
He's carrying on with his entrepreneurship, but also he continues to write. So his book, A Great Society, his father would have been very proud of it. And again, he was a 30-something-year-old thinking very profound thoughts. And I think as he gets older, he will become even more profound. And that's a source of pride and consolation for me.
So I think we've covered some dreams and some hope, but what about betrayal? I mean, do you feel that you've been betrayed by a lot of people in terms of not just politics and South African hypocrisy and, you know, society and people kind of stereotyping and all the rest of it? But do you feel a personal sense of betrayal by the country, by the people who we've entrusted the leadership to?
Well, I feel first of all, that I betrayed myself.
How so?
By getting into party politics, which I've always known that my approach to politics really was unsuitable for party politics in the current environment. It would have to be a very sophisticated environment where the values we talk about of an open society, an inclusive democracy, where equality of every citizen is recognized. That kind of value system would be one where perhaps, but then that will be when I'm already 100, so it's not going to happen. So the first thing is that I betrayed myself, because I am best when I am free to make the kind of choices that I've made all my life. And now I'm back in that space, and I'm feeling absolutely fabulous. Second, yes, I do believe that we were betrayed, not just by today's ANC government, but starting with my beloved father, the decisions that were taken with regard to the transformation of education, of health, and a whole range of sectors could have been done better.
Are you and speaking when you say your beloved father?
I'm talking about Madiba.
Madiba, yeah.
Yes. They could have been done better, because we had, in fact, internally inside South Africa, many experiments in many areas about what could work best. But the ANC came back into the country and imposed dysfunctional systems like outcomes-based education, the CETA system, all of them.
Yeah.
And when you destroy the foundations of talent development, you're destroying the country. So I feel that is the greatest betrayal of all. We also have betrayed those people, particularly the young people, who were out in the streets in the 80s, had no skills. They were told freedom now, education tomorrow, and that education never came.
Yeah.
That second chance education has yet to make a difference. So we have a whole, not one generation, set of generations that have been betrayed. And it could be so easy, because every problem we have in this country has got a solution within it. Can you imagine if we were to go to Mamelodi and pick up every young person who's washing cars or directing traffic and give them the opportunity to go and be in a camp to start with, so that they can sort out what it is that they think would be the area they want to work, whether it's a plumber, electrician, or poet, or whatever.
Sure.
Then we can support them instead of spending the bulk of the $15 billion for skills development on salaries and infrastructure for the cities. Yeah. It's a huge betrayal. Huge. And then, of course, now the ultimate betrayal is where you have a party that calls itself a liberation party, a liberation movement, that is squandering the resources of the country, left, right, and center. I mean, as Pravin Gordhan said, a school which should cost $30 million ends up costing $100 million, which means you could have built three or more schools, and you end up with one school, and poorly constructed at that. And so many of the new generation of children are continuing to be betrayed.
Do you think that maybe, though, it had to get to this? It had to get worse so that we could realize that we have so much at stake. And we had to get to a point where white people realized their only hope is to be in solidarity with black people, and where black people realized that they could not trust just the organization that claims to have liberated them, that they have to do this themselves. Don't you think this is the point to which we've come, and that gives you some solace, some hope, that maybe this is just the beginning of the real revolution?
I truly believe that, in a sense, people have now seen what some of us predicted in the 80s and 90s. And we sadly had to pay more school fees as a new democracy than we needed. But yes, I agree that now there isn't a soul in this country who can claim that they don't see the need for a new beginning.
And do you think that there's still more for you to do? Are you going to continue to be the activist and be political the way that you always were?
Undoubtedly, because I'll never give up until my maker remembers me. I believe that the work that needs to be done between now and the end of the, let's say until 2020, is the work of reigniting the dream of what country we would like to have. And to help trigger, catalyze healing opportunities. And that's why I'm focusing my work now I'm focusing it on working with people in the education sphere. To say to them, can't we use the opportunity that life orientation offers us to do the most important orientation, which is to enable young people to emerge out of our school system as proud, responsible, contributing citizens. And I believe the work with faith-based organizations is another important arena, where they have been called to healing. So I can only remind them, because I'm not trained in their ministry, but I am a person of faith. And I believe that if they were to take this opportunity of using their leadership of parishes, of communities, of whole churches, including the South African Council of Churches, to reach out to the pain that people are still carrying. And that pain is not just from what's going on now, but multi-generational trauma on both sides. But importantly, to persuade white people that it is in their interest to acknowledge the privileges they enjoy and to apologize for that which happened to a segment of humanity of which they are a part. Because that apology would enable those who are enraged and feeling like giving up. And I've heard young people say this. I've given up on white people. I've done all that I think I can, but they remain arrogant and uncaring. I think we still have a chance of bridging that. Because when we do, we will develop the empathy that we have seen work in a place like Germany, where the West Germans were not, at the beginning, willing to do the solidarity tax deal that Helmut Kohl convinced them to do. Because they said, well, they were communists, that let them, suffer the consequences. No. He said to them, to the extent that they are suffering the consequences, you are going to suffer. Because up to all ends, it was the Nazism of Germany that led to the war,
right,
and that led to the division of Germany. And now if we want to heal, we have to acknowledge as Germans, whether East or West, that we were responsible, and we must apologize to ourselves, to the world, and take the steps. Because apology is not just saying, I'm sorry. It is being willing to take the steps to put right what went wrong. And by doing that, you create a whole new set of possibilities. Look at the German economy, the strongest in Europe. And look at who is the chancellor. a woman who came from the East. If this thing had not been done the way Helmut Kohl eventually got it to be done, they would have missed out on the talents of a Merkel. Now, how many talents are going to waste here in this country? Because white people will not acknowledge.
Why do you think they won't? I mean, I'm curious about this because you've quite rightly put the case that they would gain so much from it and lose so little. What is holding them back?
First of all, lack of leadership amongst white people. I believe that we move too quickly from the place of pain when we signed the settlement. And I mean, I am a great, I respect President de Klerk for the role he played in bridging us into the settlement process. But his job was not finished then. I know he was accused of betraying the Afrikaner people, but he, I think even now, still has a role to play to say to white people, Afrikaner and others, that we have unfinished business. Unity in diversity is not going to happen until this unfinished business is tackled. But I also believe the faith-based community, the white people who belong to and are leaders of faith-based, they must take the lead.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, they were the apologists of apartheid. They must come back and say, first of all, we apologize for having misled you, and now we are asking you to join in forgiving ourselves first and foremost, acknowledging what we have done, forgiving ourselves, and then asking for forgiveness, and then working to make a political settlement really work for every South African.
But you also said that the inferiority complex of so many black people is a major problem here too. So on the other side of this now, how do we help with self-worth? How do we get people to that point? On the other side, black people now and white.
That is where, again, faith-based organizations that are ministering to black people must move out of this prosperity church model where people now think that salvation comes with wealth. It doesn't. Wealth will not buy you the peace, the sense of self-worth, the self-respect, because if you don't respect yourself, you are not going to be able to respect the other. The levels of domestic violence in our society are a reflection of the inferiority complex, not just of black people, of men, black and white, or in the acceptance by women of an inferior position. They get beaten, they still go back, they get beaten, and until some of them are killed. And so we're talking here about something extraordinarily deep. So I believe that faith-based organizations have a big, big task ahead of them. And they need to start today by making sure they enable their priests, their pastors, their rabbis, their mullahs to engage in how do we become more effective as the enablers of this healing process so that we can then together build the South Africa that will affirm the human dignity of everybody.
You know, I love the book too because you referred to a number of historical lessons that we can learn from other countries and other parts of the world. And perhaps if people did read more about our context and our history, and if we had more available to students about our own African history, we would be a little more receptive to where our place in that history is. But I do like, at the end, you know, you leave us on a high. You write very beautifully about the golden sea sand tumbles in the waves, no longer as single grains. The wealth of the possibilities of our imagined futures, like the myriad golden grains of sand, never-ending expanse of seashores. The dream is alive. Thank you so much for writing the book.
Thank you, Cliff.
And thank you for coming to speak to us this morning.
Thank you very much for inviting me and to your listeners for listening.
And please keep on dreaming and hoping, and let's not have any more betrayals, shall we? Thank you so much, Mom.
Thank you, Cliff. Cliffcentral.com.